You are listening to Dishin' and Swishin', the world of women's hoops, on hoopfeed.com.
Hi, everybody. It's David Siegel, and since this is Thursday afternoon, that means it's time for a new Dishin' and Swishin' podcast to come to you here on hoopfeed.com. And riding on the coattails of our last two really successful weeks with roundtable discussions of the NCAA tournament, I'm pleased to bring you one more talking about the Elite Eight, wrapping it up and going forward and looking at the Final Four. And we have some people that have been with us each of the last 2 weeks, a couple of different people from each of those shows, and one newcomer. So first, let me introduce you to the panelists. First, from the Associated Press, the head of their women's basketball division, Doug Feinberg. How are you, Doug?
Good, David. Thanks.
And from ESPN and the voice of the Washington Mystics and also a coach supreme and former Final Four member, Christy Winter Scott.
Hello. Thanks for having me again, Dave.
We have the guru, Mel Greenberg, joins us once again.
Hello there, Dave.
And we have a newcomer last week to the panels. I'm pleased to welcome former head coach, Shimmy Gray-Miller. How are you, Shimmy?
I'm doing great, David. Thanks for having me back. This is the closest thing I have to a job right now. So.
And she pays me to come on. That's the amazing part about it. And I'm pleased, very pleased, to welcome a first-time panelist, the assistant coach from the Indiana Fever and ESPN commentator, Stephanie White, joins us today. Stephanie, welcome to Dishin' and Swishin'.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate you having me. I'm excited.
Well, it's my pleasure. So let's start. We might as well start with Stephanie and the Des Moines region where she was covering. And as we started to talk off the air, you know, Stephanie, you know, Baylor was dominant in the region. But one question I had before we get into the whole team discussion was, you know, we could see what happens with the dunks and all on television. But could you talk for a second, you know, when Brittany Griner had that two-handed dunk at the end of the game, could you just talk about a little bit the atmosphere and the change in the environment that just happened in the whole arena at that point?
Well, you know, the anticipation was what was so exciting, because obviously it was at a point in the game where Brittany was probably going to come out pretty soon. Everybody knew it. And she kind of just leaked out, just exploded into the backcourt. And as the pass started to go, you could kind of just feel everybody's anticipation. And as soon as she did it, you know, and the way that she did it, the crowd just erupted. And you couldn't help but just sit there and take that in. Everybody had waited for that moment. It was as exciting as it looked. And what was funny about it was the next dead ball, as soon as the sub started coming in, everybody started leaving. It's like they got their fill of Brittany Griner and saw what they came to see, and then they went home to get ready for the Monday night. But it was just an amazing, amazing environment.
One of the things that I have to really commend you about is there were so many stories and so many emotions and so many things going on and off the court in that Tennessee-Baylor game Monday night. For you to be able to even just stay focused and keep both the storylines moving and not getting bogged down during what was, you know, an interesting, if not necessarily terribly exciting at points, game, you were managed to stay on point and really kept the game very watchable and enjoyable.
Well, you know, I think our producer, Jonathan Lobovich, did a very good job of keeping us on point, too. And, of course, you know, working with Beth, she's a pro. And being that the game did seem like it wasn't quite as tight of a game as we would have liked, but it really didn't feel like that in the moment. I mean, it felt like a tight game, a close game. You could feel the emotions on each side. I mean, both teams obviously having so much to play for. So it seemed like a tighter game than what the score indicated.
Yeah, and as good as Griner was in that game, Odyssey Sims was just amazing and was such a difference maker. Shimmy, did it surprise you the way that Sims played at such an extremely high level in that game, considering, you know, the pressure that was on everybody involved, you know, her being just a sophomore?
Actually, it did. It did, David. And I was thinking about that. You know, it's funny that you said that, because I was thinking about that. I was watching her play. I kept saying over and over to myself, wow, this kid is just a sophomore. She's just a sophomore. So knowing what the stakes were, even with the whole backstory of Coach Summit, is this her last game, is this not, you knew that those Tennessee kids were going to bring it and they were going to play hard and give everything they had, and you knew that they were going to be targeting on Griner. So for Sims to step up and play the way she did, yes, I was surprised and I was extremely impressed.
You know, Doug, when you look at a game like that, you know, it seems so often, you know, I'll equate it to baseball. I always consider it the Brian Doyle rule, where he stepped up and basically won the Yankees a World Series one year. You know, you get people that just play above what you had expected from them in prior games. In that game, for example, Hayden had such a big game. And, you know, the role players on Baylor, you know, how can you figure that these kids can step up and play at such a high level under such pressure-filled circumstances?
Well, David, I think you have to look at the fact that that team is more than just a one-woman or two-woman show with Griner and Sims. And all year long, that supporting cast has done a great job for them. And sort of when Griner's had a quiet first 15 minutes, the other players have stepped up because everyone's focused on Griner, which I think is huge.
You know, one of the things that really was apparent, Christy, we'll go to you with this, is the seniors in particular, the senior stars, Strickland and Johnson, really came and played and left it all out on the court. Johnson in particular I wanted to focus on first. The, you know, the taking the fall that she did and coming back into the court, you know, just, again, the same thing. Under the circumstances, with all of the pressure and everything they played for all year, you know, how can you just continue? They continually amazed me. Can you talk about, you've coached players and you've certainly been a part of things. You know, what kind of mentality do you just have to have, that mental toughness, to be able to participate in a game like that and step up like she did?
Well, that's confidence. And all that experience at that moment, you know that it's make or break time for your entire career. So it's the confidence. And when she went down with that hard fall, I didn't think she would come back from that, because it certainly was quite traumatic looking. But with her being a senior, there was nothing that was going to keep her off the floor, and for her to be able to come back, and not just come back, but to come back and contribute and produce on the floor, was something amazing to see. But with all of those five seniors for Tennessee, you know that their hearts were in that game. There was no slacking off by them. You know that they gave all they had for their program, and obviously for Coach Pat Summit. And Holly Warrick, I don't know if you saw her post-game presser, and it was just so emotional, and you know that they put everything on the line, but sometimes that happens. You give everything and you just don't get the results you want, but you have to lay it on the line, and that's just what Tennessee did. And you have to have that inner fortitude and that heart and that desire to, no matter what happens, if you fall hard or whatever it is, you've got to come back and continue to give 100% of the 60% that you have left physically in you.
You know, Mel, you know, as the veteran here, see how polite I could put that about how much you've seen over the years? Let's talk a little bit about the coaches involved here. And, you know, Coach Summit, potentially this is the last game. Kim Mulkey has such tremendous respect for her. You know, it had to have been difficult for her. You know, can you talk for a second about, you know, these two women and the programs that they've built, and, you know, what this must have been like for them to coach in a game like this?
Well, in the case of Kim, of course, the relationship goes back to her playing days at Louisiana Tech in there, and long before UConn, Tennessee, and all that, one of the first really big rivalries as we got toward more of the modern era was Louisiana Tech and Tennessee. And as a matter of fact, there were several times where Louisiana Tech owned Tennessee in those years. So there's a relationship to begin with Kim as a player, and then there's the Olympic involvement, and Pat has been there, and you know, now you're facing this, you know, this difficult situation that you've had all year. And you know, and for the most part, I mean, really, you got to credit the Tennessee staff because of the increased responsibilities and what they've had to do this year. Obviously, Kim, coming from that far back, has a sense of history. Probably she had her choice, would have loved to be playing anybody else in Division I except Tennessee, kind of knowing the implication But, you know, as a coach, Jimmy will tell you, once that game begins, you got a job to do, and you got to just throw all that aside for the next 40 minutes.
You know, one of the things that kind of struck me towards the end of that game, you know, with, you know, Holly and Kim both doing the majority of the coaching, you had Leon Barmore sitting there and you had Pat Summitt sitting there, you know, really on the sidelines. And it's like, wow, what incredible coaching legends were there, just not even really leading the charge, just being a part of the atmosphere. And to me, that just made the game even a little bit more special than it already was. Stephanie, calling the game, and with the ebb and flow that was going on, one thing really bothered me down the stretch, and I wanted to just ask your opinion, because you saw what was going on. Obviously, you had a feel for it that you can't get during television.
Mm-hmm.
I was really disappointed that Vicki Ball was not put back into the game.
It was interesting, because we discussed it briefly, but both of us, Beth and I, were like, I wonder why Vicki Ball is not coming into the game. I mean, obviously, the only conclusion that you come to in such a short term is they want more offensive firepower to try to get themselves back into it. But from an emotional standpoint, she's the only holdover from that 2008 championship. From a defensive standpoint, she's got the size and the athleticism to at least limit Griner as much as you can. And from a leadership standpoint, she has been one of the leaders on the team all season long, very vocal, much more mature, understanding from a leadership standpoint what it takes. And so I was equally surprised that she was not on the floor or back on the floor, even with those four fouls towards the end of the ballgame.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of thought that if you were going to leave Johnson and Strickland in there, I mean, if you were going to take them all out and let them get their round of applause,
yep,
that they certainly deserved, so be it. But to leave the others in there, I thought they really did an injustice to Bob, because she, to me, if anybody deserved it, it was her.
I completely agree, 100%. And it's one of the questions that each time we were off air, we'd mention, hey, I wonder if Vicki Ball's going to come in. And, you know, and I think I might have mentioned at one point, I'm a little surprised Vicki Ball's not in the game. But she does, you know, she just means so much to that team. And each time we met with the players and the coaching staff, you know, she was the one who, her and Johnson specifically, very vocal, very much wanted to take ownership, talked about how important it was for them and for Pat, and really just one of those players that you could see was like a mother hen of the group. And it really was sad to not see her finish on the floor.
As we wrap up just talking about what has happened in the Des Moines region, I want to go around to each of you and just ask you, what was the one thing that you came out of this particular region for you that was memorable, or going forward you think is something that you're going to keep an eye on, or something that really jumped out at you? Doug, why don't you start for us? I mean, what was it out of Des Moines that really, you know, you'll remember more than anything else?
Well, I mean, it'd be easy to say the dunk or the dunks, because that's what has been shown probably hundreds of times on SportsCenter already. And I'm sure it'll be shown again 100 more times in the Final Four. But I'll go back to probably the interesting thing to me was the run that Kansas made, sort of the unexpected run behind an underrated player in Angel Goodrich, who was, I thought, really, really good in the tournament and was one of those players that lifted her team further than anybody expected. You could say Deladon had a great run. Deller just didn't have enough firepower, but Angel Goodrich got a team that no one expected to get to the Sweet 16 that far, and they gave Tennessee all they could handle. So that's what I'll go up for. Sort of the offbeat thing out of Des Moines was the run that Kansas had.
Now, what do you think?
I agree with Doug that, you know, for Kansas, it kind of helped set the table for next year in the what will be the new look, Big 12, as there will be in several conferences. But the thing about, I'll say about Delaware, only because of what I get, you know, interaction in terms of traffic and all, is that, you know, back in the days of the whole Connecticut story and all, you know, people were just Googling Deladon every day. And then sort of like she had her big year, but at this point she had just kind of fitted in, you know, it was no longer a phenomenon. She was doing that role. But once she was on TV, I just suddenly saw the numbers all start jumping again, where people were just Googling different things, you know, with her name and coming in. So, you know, it's such a nice situation for Delaware for next year. And then, of course, you know, overall that, you know, the implications of the Baylor-Tennessee game. You know, we don't know. I guess we may not know for a couple of days or a couple of weeks what it means in terms of Tennessee, but, you know, certainly that's the lasting moment.
Christy?
Well, everything that everyone else has said, number one, is definitely something that will stick in my mind out of that area. But when you look at a Pat Summit, I think for me that's the biggest story of when we played them in the Final Four in 89, and we were one of those one-seeded teams. You know, she has just done so much for the women's game and the respectability that comes from just getting a glimpse of her on the bench and just to see the support system that she had with her was just amazing to me in terms of the history of the game. So I think of all of the fantastic things that that bracket possessed, I think for me, the top of the list would be Pat Summit and how courageous she was to come out and let everyone know about her issues with dementia and to be able to sustain herself throughout the season and to be able to continue to motivate her team to do well. And I think that, you know, they did have the 3 home losses, which was the most ever. And, you know, there were some issues throughout the year, but her team was full of warriors and they got that instinct and that mindset from their coach.
Timmy? Timmy?
I'm sorry about that. I'm going to go with the obvious, you know, what's most glaring to me when you think of the Des Moines region, you think of Baylor. And so with that, it's not Griner and it's not her dunks, but it's Odyssey Sims. What she showed me through these first few games is just exactly how dominant she is. And I don't believe that there's a more dominant player at the point guard position in the game today.
And it's been there? You haven't been there?
Yeah, you know, I completely agree about Baylor. I mean, they have been the most dominant team all year long, and the reality is they go about 6.5 deep, and they've been able to continue to be the most dominant team. But, you know, for me, having been there, it's got to be watching Pat Summit walk off the floor. If that was the last time that she walks off the floor, and for me it was an emotional time. I felt very honored to be able to be there in that moment. She represents everything that we want and love about sports. You know, she's a legend, not just because she won a lot of basketball games, but she handles herself with class. She always takes the time to help mentor young coaches in the game. She always takes the time to sign autographs after the ball game. I mean, she means everything that you want a role model to be and has taken our game to a place where I'm sure at the time she started she could never have imagined. And as a coach in the game, as a fan of the game, and as a commentator now, just to watch her walk off the floor was a very humbling experience and one that I'll never forget.
And I'm going to say the thing that I'm going to remember the most is the fact that Kim Mulkey disappointed me terribly through the entire regional by wearing clothes that were totally non-offensive to the eye. You know, she actually let her team take over and play on the court and not give anybody anything to tweet about her wardrobe.
I don't know about that, David. That Marilyn McCoo solid gold jacket that she had on in the first round was kind of hard on the eyes. But
well, all right, we'll give you that. Especially you get bonus points for bringing out the Marilyn McCoo reference. Definitely. So Baylor advances, and they get to take on the Flying Agumake sisters, the trapeze artists of the Pac-12. And they played just unbelievably against Duke and through the entire bracket. And the way that they played, everybody now suddenly thinks that Stanford really has a chance against Baylor in the next round. So Doug, I'm going to go straight to you and ask you the question that I have been wondering is, people are talking about that that Baylor has not seen anything like the Agumakes, but despite the Chelsea Grays and some of the people and whoever's in the Pac-12, Boyd in particular was thrown at me from California. Has Stanford seen anybody like Odyssey Sims?
That's a good question. I don't know if in this year they've seen anybody like Odyssey Sims. I think in the past they've probably seen some guards who are as good as she is, but she'll probably be the difference. I think if you take two Ogumakes against one Griner, that's probably a pretty good matchup, I would think. I mean, they can actually probably body her up a little bit. If Brittany has to guard one of them, she could bring them outside where they can actually hit the three now, so they could cause some matchup problem for Griner in a sense. But, yeah, I mean, Sims is a player that Stanford probably hasn't seen a guard as good as all season long. You did mention Gray, who's pretty good for Duke, and Boyd for Cal, but no, I mean, there is no Odyssey Sims. I may actually have to, I'm sure I'll get to it, but as you like to say, dish and switch over to Mel as far as later on if the Ogumakes are the best tandem ever in the post, because he's got more of the history than I do. But those two sisters, I mean, they are something special to watch, and it is kind of neat that they are sisters doing this together on a team that is. Stanford has been really good all season long in the 32-game winning streak. So they'll, I think, present a challenge to Baylor in the Final Four this weekend.
One thing, too, from Odyssey Sims, from a defensive standpoint, have they not faced anybody what she can do offensively? Because sometimes she can kind of come and go offensively. What she does defensively, can they get the ball up the floor and get it to the Ogumake sisters as easily as they've been able to so far in the tournament?
You beat me to it, Seth. That was exactly what my next question was going to be, was, you know, Stanford is not exactly known for having the most stable ball handlers. Orange has certainly stepped in and done a very fine job at the last half of the season, but I'm wondering, to me, Sims may be the best on-ball defender I've seen as a guard in college basketball in a number of years. So I have that same question. You know, Shimmy, what do you think about whether or not Stanford could possibly handle the ball, getting it across court even, to set up the Ogumakes in a reasonable time?
You know, I said this the last time that we talked, is that, you know, Stanford doesn't get enough credit at times, I think, for, you know, they're deceptively athletic, but they've never faced a backcourt like Baylor. At least this year they haven't. And I do not think that they've faced a player as close to Odyssey Sims. In my opinion, Chelsea Gray and Boyd from Cal, they are lesser versions of Odyssey Sims. You know, she's strong, she's fast, and she's mean. And just like Christy brought up, she's as dominant on the defensive end as she is on the offensive end. I went to Point Guard College a couple years ago, and they use this term there that really embodies Odyssey Sims. She hunts the paint. And I think that Stanford will have a difficulty keeping her out of the paint.
You know, the thing is, you mentioned that, you know, Chelsea Gray being perhaps a lesser version. You know, Chelsea Gray did score 22 points against Stanford in that last game and have 4 assists. So she did have a good game, which further leads me to wonder how explosive Sims potentially could be. You know, Christy, though, you know, Stanford, an interesting point was the deceptive athleticism. It seems that there are other players that are not named Ogumake, you know, don't look like they should be able to do the things that they do, but yet they do. Especially, you know, you get the tinkles in there, and, you know, they seem to get a little bit of everything out of some of these other players. And Tara seems to really get the most out of her team.
Right, and Tara Vanderveer obviously is the best at doing that, but you have players like Tinkle. I mean, she hit some huge shots in the second half to really stretch that game against Duke, and you have players like Orange, and they're just complementary players, but they do it so well, and they feed off of each other so well. And I think one thing that I'll touch upon that Stephanie was saying is that, yes, defense is going to be a key, but at the same time, I think that Stanford moves so well without the ball. They're a tough scout. I mean, they execute their offense, but they also read and react very well, especially the sisters. And, you know, the Ogumakes, they see each other high-low, and they just have that innate read ability, if you will, and to the pass
the pass where it needs to be. And I think if they can control the offensive boards, they won't need to worry about the pressure on the offensive guards out top to get them the ball inside. I think if they crash the boards, they can create a lot of offense that way and possibly get Brittany Griner in foul trouble.
Steph, one of the things that I think that did concern me a little bit watching Baylor was early on especially, Griner seemed to allow herself to get lured out to the high post a little bit more than I thought she should have, which is deadly against the Igwumakes because you look at one and the other will come in from behind you.
Right.
I think it's going to take a lot of discipline for her to really stay down low, even at the expense of giving up that foul line jumper at times.
Well, and if there's one criticism of Brittany Griner's game, and it's not even really a criticism, is that she does play very upright. And sometimes if very physical, you're able to root her out. But I feel like she has been able to add, you know, that off the dribble from that high post. The move that she made, and I think it was in the early game, from the three-point line where she just drove it right down the middle of the lane and laid it up on the other side, I have never seen that from Brittany Griner. You know, she's able to take it off the dribble a little bit more. She's able to facilitate a little bit more. But I do think you're right. She needs to get low. She needs to get down and establish herself early and play with that fire early in the ball game. And I think if she can do that and establish herself, she's going to open it up for everybody else. I mean, there's not – every game, Nene Hayden's not going to come out and have 15 points in the first half. I mean, Nene Hayden and Odyssey Sims carried them in the first half offensively. Is she going to step up? Absolutely. But I think Brittany Griner has got to be the focal point offensively. She's got to go establish herself down low and then let everybody else get involved. She can't allow everyone to get involved and then say, okay, I'm going to turn it up in the second half. I don't think you can do that against Stanford.
Now Doug sort of asked the question that I really want to get all of you to give an opinion on. Someone threw out to me the idea, are the Igwumakes the best duo, the best tandem in a front court in women's college basketball history? Now, I thought of Lobo and Walters, and somebody threw out to me McGee and Miller. Now, as the vet again in our group, is that a legitimate statement? Could the Igwumakes be the best post duo in college basketball history?
Well, they might be athleticism, but you just hit the illusion that once upon a time there was a team called Southern Cal, and while the name Cheryl Miller is the name that comes out of that, same team that, by the way, had Sophia Cooper on there as sort of like a bit player, we had the twin sister tandem of Pam and Paula McGee, one of which is heading to the Women's Basketball Hall of Fame this June, and they were pretty good. There was also another pair, probably would be in the mix, but probably not better. You go back to the Virginia Dawn Staley days, and of course, and Christy is probably more contemporary to that, which is the Burge sisters, Heidi and Heather Burge. But I think when you're talking about in today's world, anyhow, the Igwumakes are there, but over the whole, it would be interesting to see a game with all the right pieces matching up against the McGees.
Yeah. You know, another one, too, if Charlotte Smith and Sylvia Crawley, now they were a little bit different, but they were also a pretty front court to have.
Yeah.
You know, I wouldn't be me if I didn't throw in a Flint, Michigan reference, you know, with that being my hometown and all. So I pretty much have the McGee twins. They were my idols growing up as a small child. And I've got to go old school, and I've got to go with the McGee twins. You know, you're talking about two 2,000-point scorers, two 1,000, you know, rebounds in their career, two-time national champions. Both of them were All-Americans, and they did this while playing with arguably the greatest player to ever play to lace up her shoes in the game, and that's Cheryl Miller. So I love what Shanae and Necky, what they're doing and what they've done, but I've got to go with the McGee twins.
And I have to agree with that. And I was definitely a fan as well, watching them play and winning that championship, being undefeated. So those sisters were very complimentary, but still, like you said, Jenny, they were All-American.
and they had, you know, 2,000 points and everything. They were awesome on the floor and had that chemistry, much like Stanford has in terms of being balanced. But with that being said, I don't think that there's been another post duo, sisters or not, that match up with the McGee twins.
You know, it's funny that that it's all family, you know, it's all sisters that you guys keep throwing out as combinations. That, you know, there certainly must be some sort of cynicism, you know, to be a cynic here, you know, there's got to be some non-family member combos there someplace, doesn't there?
Yeah, I'll give you one, and one of them is going into the Hall of Fame is Old Dominion with Lieberman, because when Ann Myers was a freshman and you had Ing Nissen, who had been there as a senior, they were the first group that we were calling the Twin Towers. And they were pretty good, you know, between Nancy doing her thing and those two, they got to be right up there also, especially, you know, when you get away from the non-family aspect.
Yeah, Steph,
well, Dave, is it fair to... Is it fair you can maybe say Griner and whoever else you want to put as the other post player there, since she's probably going to be the best post player in the history of the game?
Yeah, staying in the contemporaries, you know, let me – what about the Tina Charles and Maya Moore?
You know, it's interesting because I guess when I think front court, I think of two players who play predominantly in the middle of the floor, and Maya Moore played in the front court, but she also played everywhere else. And I mean, I think it's certainly worth discussion, but, when I think about it, I really think about a high-low post tandem, and you really, without the ones that were mentioned already, and with the Agumake sisters, I can't think of too many others. Now, Louisiana Tech used to have some pretty good post players as well, but off the top of my head, I can't think of two on the same team.
No, I think you're right. I'm just trying to come up with some other combinations. Yeah. Steph, does the Midwest have anybody, or do you guys just have guards out there?
No, you know, it's interesting because it's such a transition. You go from having eight straight in two players, Big Ten Player of the Years, in Jessica Davenport and Jantel Lavender, and now it's all guards. And I don't think there's anybody close to the tandem that those two represent in today's game, nowhere near it.
You know, I could even throw into the argument Jones and Cash when they played at UConn. You know, when they were together, that 2002 team, you've got two All-Americans on arguably, you know, the most dominant team ever. But still, when you look at numbers, you know, and statistics, they just don't compare
right.
to the McGee twins.
I'd say this about the McGees, too, because the word's been mentioned in talking about them, which is why I thought about them, is that as good as the Gumagays are, they still haven't won a championship yet, and those other two won. Two of them. Granted, they had Cheryl Miller, but they, you know, at least with NECA before her sister got there, there were a lot of players that are now in the WNBA that were, you know, on that Stanford team.
Yeah, very good. We will hand it for this year. The discussion, it goes to the McGee twins. I can thank you all for your input on that. I think that was a good question, and I appreciate the fact that was asked to me on Twitter, so I thought that was a great question. So, the first game on Tuesday night, Kentucky and Connecticut played at the University of Rhode Island, and it was a game where it was a game for a half, and then in the second half, Connecticut just pulled away. What bothered me the most about the game was the fact that the referees took a lot of the flow out of the game, and as we go forward into the Final Four, that brought up to me my biggest concern, and that is that the referees will find a way to impact these next two games coming up and then the final. What do you do, Christy, as a coach, when you have referees that start taking you out of your rhythm, never mind the players themselves in foul trouble? I'm talking about just trying to get things going and just a perpetual whistle, whistle, whistle.
Well, I tell you what, I'm a marcher on the sidelines, so it's tough because you really want to keep your players focused on the game, and it is tough when you're struggling and you're trying to get back into the game. And, you know, I'm very animated as a coach, but at the same time you have to –
try to stay even keeled in terms of your emotions. And I know that he did get that technical, but he said, thank you, I don't care. I needed that because, you know, this is just getting ridiculous. So I understand the frustration with that, but at the same time, that's the way they're going to call it this half, then you have to adjust as a player. And as a coach, you know, as tough as it is of a pill to swallow, you have to make that adjustment as well and try your best to keep your players focused on what we need to do instead of what has already happened. So you can't change what's happened. So we go like in 4-minute segments in the second half. So in that 4 minutes, we had a lot of calls that didn't go our way. We're not going to waste half the time out talking about, you know, what happened in the latter 4 minutes, but we do have 4 minutes ahead of us. This is how they're going to call it, so this is what we're going to do. And so you just have to keep them in the moment, keep them focused, and try your best as a coach to maintain your composure and poise on the sidelines.
Jimmy, would you have lasted as long as Matthew Mitchell did before he finally got that tee?
Matthew is a better man than me because I probably would have got one a lot sooner than that. I agree with Christy 100%, and I would tell my players all the time is control what we can control. You cannot control the calls that the officials make. We have to, you know, we'll have to make adjustments to how they are officiating this game. But it was very ugly, and you would hope that at this point in the season that you would get officials out there who they realize it's not about them. It's about the game and the quality of the game and the players that are out on the court. But sometimes that's not always the case.
Now, Doug, you saw a number of UConn games this year and also, you know, obviously being up here in the Northeast over the course of the last few years. Tiffany Hayes had, for good reason, gotten a bit of this reputation for disappearing when it came time for big games. But was that perhaps the best all-around game last night that you've seen her play?
You know, David, I think it was. If I can drop back for 1 second here about the officiating last night, because I was sitting there watching the game live, and it's funny, the first half there are 27 free throws taken, and I don't think, at least sitting there, it really affected the game flow that much. It seemed like they were still getting up and down the court. There was a whistle here and there. Just everything happened to be shooting free throws, whereas the second half it was out of control where I don't think you went 2 possessions for about a 7-minute stretch without a whistle blowing. And it was so bad watching it live. I can only imagine on TV how ugly it looked from the basketball standpoint of the game being just whistle, 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 whistle. But that said, I mean, Tiffany Hayes, you hope your senior players step up and have games when you need them to. And she had lived in the shadow of Maya Moore, Tina Charles, Renee Montgomery for the last 3 years. And I think Graham Hayes of ESPN told me last night when we were just about to ready to leave the media room that he had talked to Heather Buck and heard the best quote ever from her about Tiffany Hayes, that game summed up Tiffany Hayes' career. She showed flashes of brilliance early, then seemed to disappear for a little bit, and then in the end came on strong when they needed her to. And that's what she did, and that's what, again, what you hope senior leaders do. And she was one last night, getting every loose ball. She got hit in the head. She hit the floor probably 50 times, which she normally does, but got up and found ways to make big shots and big plays to get UConn to, as she said, the sweetest of their Final Fours in the last 4 years for her. And I mean, she was great. She was what you hoped she would be coming out of that program after spending 4 years there.
Yeah, Stephanie, the most impressive numbers to me out of that entire anything you read about that game, 21 assists on 23 field goals. That has to do the guard in you a lot of really good warm feelings.
The guard and the coach, you know, and it's just
this is true.
You watch their execution offensively. I mean, there have been many times where it wasn't as crisp, but their spacing, their timing, you absolutely know what Kentucky brings day in and day out. It's obvious they were prepared for that, and they went out and they didn't allow it to take them out of their game plan, and they took what the defense gave them. And I felt like more than any other game I've watched Connecticut this year, they stayed true to the scout. They stayed true to what they are offensively. They didn't get rattled. They didn't get rushed. They were very poised on the offensive end. And we saw a bit of it when Hartley was out with foul trouble, a bit of problems. But they very quickly got right back to it. And you're absolutely right. Tiffany Hayes, her leadership at that moment, I felt like was better than it has been throughout her entire career. But as far as an execution standpoint, I feel like Connecticut is playing the best basketball that they've played all season long and have just done an outstanding job.
Now, Mel, you've seen, you know, all the Geno teams that have been so good over the recent past and, you know, some from the beginning, how he's evolved as a coach. It's not often that he doesn't have that one real go-to player like he doesn't have this year. Was this, he said he didn't think he did a great job this year at one point. Do you think that this is one of his best coaching jobs? Because I really think it is.
I think there's no question. I really do. You look at where Stephanie Dolson has come. Look at where Bria Hartley has come. I mean, Kelly Ferris steps up and seems to make the big play whenever they need it. I mean, to get this team to the Final Four from where they started at the beginning of the year to now, I think it's definitely one of his best.
Now your voice changed.
Yeah, well, you know.
Hey,
I've been accused of being.
Anybody jumps in when they want to. So
yeah.
Oh, I thought you said Steph.
Sorry.
Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, I would agree. You know, you go back. Of course, from Geno, you never know what you're getting when he says something at a given moment in terms of where he's really at. But you know, you go back. I'll tell you what. There's gonna be a lot of pressure on him next year because of that Chamber of Commerce statement at the beginning of the year where he said. We don't really have a chance to win this year, I don't think, you know. And he said there's three teams better. He says now unless somebody messes up and, you know, considering that Tennessee was in that mix preseason, he used the word mess up the way he used it, but in essence that's what happened. Somebody went by the wayside and, you know, changed the way the bracket comes out and the way everything else works itself out. But, you know, he said now the next 2 years we may not lose a game. So, especially when you look at what's coming in. I mean, that's the amazing thing. They got an outside shot to win this thing, and this is what we're calling the rebuilding year. But really, I know he made that statement after the not doing a good job after the second Notre Dame game, and then, you know, they had a week to get ready for the Big East tournament, and then the lights went on. So, you know, maybe part of this is just his way of prepping for the real pressure job this year, which will be coaching the Olympics this summer.
Christy, one thing I want to ask you, I want to visit Kentucky for a second. I thought that Matthew Mitchell's team was one of the most impressive that I've seen and one of the most maddening that I've seen because they come in so many waves and they play so hard and they commit so many turnovers at bad times. Yeah, that's one of those teams where they're on the rise, and I think that Kentucky is going to be a real force, not only next year in the SEC, but also on the national level for years to come.
Well, I totally agree with that, and in terms of them being maddening, I think they also missed some really great opportunities to score. They weren't knocking shots down, and for me, I think those count as turnovers because when you're playing a team like UConn, they're going to be on the boards and they're going to push the tempo and score on you quickly. And then that's how they get you in those holes. That's how you look up and you're down by six and you blink and you're down 20. And it's because you're not taking care of the ball, number one, but number two, you're not taking a great shots in terms of being in the rhythm of your offense. And I think in that second half, yes, it was disjointed because of the fouls that were being called, but at the same time, you have to try to really press through because of that and stick with your game plan and try to stay in rhythm offensively. And I think in the second half in that game, they were just really out of rhythm. And because they were missing those shots, UConn was able to get out on the fast break and get easy transition buckets. But, yes, the future is definitely bright for them. And I think Matthew has done such a great job with that team. And I know that he was obviously not happy with the result of that contest, but I think that, you know, in hindsight, looking at the year as a total package, I think that he's very pleased with where his team came from November to now.
Yeah, one thing that impressed me last night also about him was the press conference post-game where, you know, I've sat through so many Big East press conferences this year where certain coaches that shall remain nameless never gave credit and just said, well, we missed shots, we turned the ball over. No, it wasn't anything that they did. Well, Matthew Mitchell went in there yesterday and said, you know, we didn't execute, but they were great. They did what they had to do. They made the plays, all credit to Connecticut. And he gave the credit that they were due, and I was very impressed by that. I thought that he handled things very well. Now, Doug, speaking of presses, there's one thing I do have to touch on. Now, you were there, I assume, for media day on Monday. Can you tell for a second, how about a little bit of credit, I think, a lot of credit has to be given to Samari Walker for being able to handle what was thrown at her on Monday?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. First, though, with Matt, because I was there last night, he actually took it a step further and blamed himself for a lot of the problems in the loss last night. It wasn't just about giving credit to Connecticut, which he definitely did, but he also, like, he blamed himself for bad team management, didn't have them prepared enough, though, so UConn jumped out to a 9-0 lead, and then changes that were made, and he took a lot of the onus for the loss last night on himself, at least three times blaming himself for the loss, which to me as a coach, that's a heck of a thing to do since he's gotten them so far. And a lot of coaches take credit for wins, but to take yourself in the spotlight for the loss, hats off to him. Samari Walker, I mean, look, she was going up to Connecticut. Someone actually asked her, I forget who it was, about, you knew there was going to be this when the bracket came out if they met the questions. And she handled herself with so much class. She admitted that it wasn't the right fit for her to be in Connecticut, and she was happy with her decision to go to Kentucky. And she answered every question out front and forthright and really gave, I thought, honest and genuine answers. And she's a 20, 21-year-old girl who is used to some of the media spotlight, having been in Connecticut for half a season. But I really thought, I mean, every question that was thrown her way, and there were a bunch of them, she handled it and never seemed to get upset by it and never really lost her temper or had any sort of raise of her voice. And she really handled it with class.
And she played great last night.
She did. I mean, she was a force. She kept them in the game in the first half with a lot of key rebounds and played really well. And they just, I mean, it was 8-2 at one point, fouls in the second half. UConn had two and Kentucky had eight. And if one or two fouls had gone the other way, UConn could have been in serious foul trouble. When we talked before about Baylor only having 6.5 kids, UConn only played six last night with Kia Stokes, who's been so good lately, getting like 3 minutes of garbage time. So they could have been in a lot of hot water, had a couple whistles gone the other way, and who knows what the result would have been in the end.
Well, let's move forward, and it's time to go into the church and synagogue of Dishin' and Swishin'. It's confession time, guys. Who picked Maryland to beat Notre Dame?
Christy, I have my hand up. Oh, it's sad.
Well, you know, Christy, you knew that I was going to call you out on the Maryland game because,
yeah.
You know, I know you watched it closer than anybody else for sure. And, you know, the performance, I'm not going to say anything bad about Maryland. They've had a phenomenal season. But that performance that Notre Dame put on last night was just an absolute clinic. And, so I will let you give the first kudos to Notre Dame for easily the best performance in the Elite Eight.
Okay, let me take a deep breath. Okay, no, they really did play tremendous. And I'm telling you, the balance that they played with, and Skylar Diggins with her first career triple-double with the 22 points, 11 assists, and 10 rebounds, that was just spectacular to watch. And just with the ease that she did it with as well. And she showed so much confidence on the floor, not just with her own performance, but to get those 11 assists, she showed confidence in her teammates as well. And they didn't turn her down in terms of being there for her when she dropped off a great pass. They were there for her. And they were all there for one another. In terms of what they did to take Maryland out of their game, was outstanding. And we're talking about a Maryland team, and I'm taking my alumni hat off for a moment. We're talking about a Maryland that pretty much led the nation in rebounding the entire year. And to be demolished on the boards that way was very surprising to me, because that was the bonus point that they had in terms of the matchups when you're looking at things, pros and cons for each group. that was a pro for Maryland, to be able to attack the boards and to be able to push the pace and get the ball out. And Mincy really didn't do what she typically does, but I think it's because Notre Dame really did a good job of paying attention to both Thomas and Mincy on the offense for Maryland, and they just didn't get anyone else to pick up the tempo and the rhythm on the offensive end, but I think it started on the defensive end for Maryland, and they were having such a tough time containing all of the players, not just Skylar Diggins, but all of the players. They were scoring in the lane at will, and I don't know how many layups Notre Dame made, but they were able to make that happen because of the way they stretched Maryland's defense out. And it was just really, as an alum now putting my hat back on, it was tough to watch that because you know that Maryland had worked tremendously hard all season and won 31 games. They were 31-5 this season. Their seniors, their three seniors are going out, having gone to two Elite Eights and won two ACC championships. So nothing to hold their heads down about, but I'm sure that that's not the Maryland team that I had seen play on several occasions this season, but credit Notre Dame for taking them out of the way they wanted to play.
Jimmy, I'm going to let you talk about the one that I know is one of your faves, Natalie Novosel. Last night, only 5 of 9 shooting, 6 rebounds, but, you know, no assists? I mean, the girl can't pass the ball?
Bench her. I think Muffet should bench her for the Final Four. Now, I mean, everyone, obviously Diggins is the All-American, and so everyone, it's Diggins, 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 but I believe that Novosel is, you know, is the MVP of this Notre Dame team, and her numbers weren't, you know, phenomenal last night, but she is the glue and the heart, maybe not the heart, but the soul of this Notre Dame team. So there's no way that Notre Dame, that they do what they do without Natalie Novosel.
Doug, what is it about NCAA tournaments that seems to suddenly wake up Natalie Achonwa, that she becomes this totally different beast in the lane? This is 2 years in a row where you've looked at her and gone, over the course of the season, and then come tournament time, she's amazing.
I'd say maybe it's a Canadian thing. I mean, she's had experience playing in big games. She played for the Canadian national team on the World Championships 2 years ago, and she's played in obviously pretty big games. I mean, I don't know if you can compare that to NCAA tournament games, but it's got to be somewhat close, I would think, playing internationally on the big stage and playing in the NCAA big stage. But, yeah, she's impressive, and it helps when you have a Diggins, Novosel, Peters around to sort of take a little bit of the pressure off you, that you can just do your role. You can just be that offensive rebounding force, a defensive rebounding force, and no, you're not probably the first, second, third, or fourth person that people put on their scouting report. I'll defer to the coaches here on this one, that if you're looking at Notre Dame, I think she's probably the fourth or fifth person you'd look at after probably even Kylie McBride, as far as we have to stop this person. And that makes life easier when there's that forgotten player who knows her role well and does it well, and that's why I think she's excelled so far in the NCAAs this year and last year.
Yep. Shimmy, if she knows the role, that means what else does she have to do?
Shut her hole.
Do you know how many times I went around this week, ever since you said that in last week's roundtable, all week I've been telling everybody, know your role and shut your hole.
Life would be so much better if everyone followed that philosophy.
He should start team next year, Steady, by the way.
Yeah, you know what, Steph, I think first day, tell Tamika Catchings that. And see what her response is. Steph, one of the things about Skylar that has really intrigued me over the year is the way that she lets the game come to her for the most part and allows her teammates to do whatever they got to do, and then she takes over when she has to. Last night, and similar to last year in the tournament, she took over from the start. She just said, this is going to be my game, and I'll let you play with my ball. When she does that, I find her to be one of the most enjoyable players to watch in men's or women's basketball.
Hello. Stephanie, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. You got me? Okay. Yeah.
I think you're absolutely right, and I think that she needs to do that for Notre Dame to be successful. She is a player who can dominate a game, and she makes her teammates so much better. When she's aggressive, everybody has to be aware of where she is, and she's finding her teammates and getting them the ball at the right end. And I felt like last night, I mean, the first time in the postseason that Notre Dame has played Notre Dame basketball, and I attribute it to the way that Skylar Diggins came out to start the basketball game.
You know, now, Muffet McGraw has never gotten a lot of the credit that she deserves. And, well, she hasn't until recently. Now she's finally gotten that Women's Basketball Hall of Fame induction. You know, the way that she was able to get this team ready for this game, coming off of, you know, the blowout against St. Bonaventure, I was really wondering if they were going to come out flat. But she had them ready. She had a game plan that was fantastic. You know, she did some amazing things with that team, getting them ready for last night's game.
Yeah, she probably doesn't get a lot of the, like you said, though, more in maybe the last year or so, getting a lot more credit in there in terms of game preparation and what they do over the years. You know, I think the other thing that was a little helpful was, Christy could probably speak to it, is how much energy that Merlin had to expend 2 days before in coming back from 18 down at Texas A&M. I mean, that may have sown the seeds for, you know, Merlin's situation to begin with, and then and maybe Muffet seeing this, knowing that they might be a little spent, you know, designed the game plan accordingly. And, you know, they're kind of like, you know, everybody's got a little different mission in this Final Four, even though it's a familiar cast. Notre Dame with the upset last year, UConn, which people didn't see coming, and then, you know, had a chance to finish the job and didn't against A&M. You know, Stanford, of course, this is number 5, and they're 0-4 in this run. Connecticut, probably nothing to lose. I mean, this is the one year that going into the finals, there's probably a little less pressure on them. And then, of course, Baylor, because they were the standard bearer all year long. So it's going to be interesting this weekend. But, you know, with Muffet, I mean, you look at she played for, you know, I mean, she was an assistant to Jim Foster at St. Joe's, played back here, Philadelphia basketball. Went into a Notre Dame program that was basically not anywhere yet, just getting its legs in Division I when she got hired. And, of course, has just done great things with them over the years.
So now we get UConn Notre Dame Book 4. And, Doug, I was waiting for this part to let you talk about one of our favorites, the girl that's been making a difference in these games all season, and that's Kayla McBride. And I think that going into this game, it's again going to have to be McBride that steps up and does some things on offense and on defense.
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, it's funny. The Notre Dame game was at the half last night when UConn was doing its press conference. And I asked Juno about it, saying, assuming they're going to win, what's your thoughts on facing Notre Dame again? And he shook his head, and he's like, again? Like 4 times? That's just too much. And it's 8 times in 2 years they've played, 11 in 3 years. And 4 times this year. And, I mean, talk about 2 teams that know each other inside and out. There's nothing that they can do in the next 6 days or 5 days or even 3 days now to get themselves ready to try something really that different against each other. A couple tweaks when they played in the championship game of the Big East tournament and they were able to pull out the victory, their defense a little better, it was a little slower pacing. McBride had a pretty good game there to start. They couldn't just get enough help from anybody else for Notre Dame to pull it out. But, yeah, I mean, I think if McBride played last year in the NCAA tournament, in the championship game, Notre Dame probably wouldn't have unfinished business. They'd be the defending national champions right now. She just opens up another scoring threat, another good shooter from the outside, a pretty good defender. She just gives Notre Dame another option on offense that I think that makes life easier for them to beat teams that are pretty good and coming into this weekend, having – them cooking in all cylinders, they'll need McBride to be the one to, I think, step up and hit some shots to make easier life for Novosel, Diggins, and Peters.
You know, I can't imagine, honestly, playing a team in a college environment 4 times in a season that has this type of skills, as both of these 2 teams do. Now, Jimmy, if you were coaching in these circumstances, what do you do to get your team ready that's different than you've done any other time?
You know, at this point, David, I'm not really sure that you do, spend a lot of time putting in new plays or trying to do anything different in preparation that you've done the previous three times. You've got to stick with what's got you to this point. I mean, maybe you might tweak this, or maybe you might put in, add a different out-of-bounds play or a sidelines play or a quick hitter. But at this point, you've got to stick with what has gotten you to the point where you are.
You know, Christy, one of the things that struck me is, the perfect Tyre Vanderveer, not necessarily an answer to a question, the answer today in the press conferences was they asked about defending Griner and what they would do this week, and she just said, we're going to worry not about her, we're going to worry about us, which is really what I think at this point, wouldn't you say that's what both of these two teams have to do?
I would say that's what both teams have to do on any other given circumstance, but you have to come up with something for Griner. She's just not saying. I'm sorry, that's coach speak, and she just creates so many different issues for you because of her 9'2" reach. I'm sorry, you have to plan accordingly for that, and that's not something that you see game in and game out, so I'm sure she's telling her players, yes, we're focused on our game plan in terms of how we want to execute offensively and what we're going to do to counter the challenge that Brittany Griner and her effect has on the game. But with that being said, I think that Stanford will stay true to their execution, but I think they're going to have something up their sleeve. They have to have something up their sleeve in order to counter Brittany Griner inside.
Steph, when you see Diggins play like she did last night, and you're Gino Auriemma, and you've seen her do this to your team at various times. You know, last year in stores, she had 20 at the half in a game. Yeah, do you game plan for Diggins, or again, do you just say that, you're UConn, you're going to play your defense that's been so successful and let it go?
Well, it's interesting because I think by the time you've played somebody for a fourth time again, Gino probably thinks, well, if I game plan for Skylar Diggins, then Natalie Novotel's going to go off, or Devereaux Peters is going to go off, or somebody else is going to go off. I mean, I certainly think that they'll probably do some different things, whether it be showing different looks, trapping every once in a while, coming out of a timeout with something different. But UConn's a pretty good defensive team. And I felt like in the Big East tournament, they took Notre Dame out of anything that they wanted to do offensively. And I think that they tweak a few things here and there, but you stick to what got you to that point, I feel like, because they're playing some of the best basketball of the season, and then throw a couple of things at you. And I think that they will. I think we'll see a couple of new things on Diggins, but I think that he knows that team inside out, and he doesn't want to allow someone else the opportunity to go off.
So, Mal, tell me, is this going to be 2001 revisited, where UConn wins the Big East championship and then gets knocked out in the Final Four as Notre Dame moves to their championship? Or can UConn win this game on Sunday? Is this going to be their time to even the series?
Well, it could go either way. I don't know the dynamics of 2001, because remember they won the Big East and then it came back. But then, you had that last year. They won three times and nobody saw it coming. And then, Notre Dame beat them in the semifinals, where everybody thought it was going to be a three-peat. I think it's just going to be who comes to play, who's prepared, probably a test of wills. It could go either way. They're both coming out of great games over the weekend in the regional. It'll be interesting.
All right, so we give Mel a non-answer. Doug, who do you think is going to win this weekend?
Well, I will say, David, that I picked when the first bracket came out in Selection Monday, it was going to be a UConn-Baylor final. So with Notre Dame and Stanford also being there, and I'd be foolish to go against what I put out there 2.5 weeks ago. I think in two-game series, UConn is tough to beat with Gino in charge. And I'll
throw it over to the coaches for a better view on this, but I got to think that UConn is tougher this year for Notre Dame. Last year, you know, if you stopped Maya Moore or contained her, UConn would sort of be out of sorts. Whereas this year, there isn't that one person on offense that if you stop them, UConn's in trouble. Because Tiffany Hayes stepped up last night. Bria Hartley stepped up the game before. Stephanie Dolson can step up. Clayton Mosqueda-Lewis can step up. There's a lot of choices out there. And you stop one head, another three will grow. So I'll defer to them as far as how Notre Dame could beat this team this year. But I picked UConn all along to win the national championship. And as I said, I'd be a fool to change my thought now that they're all in the Final Four.
Jimmy, we'll let you take Doug's segue.
I'm going to, you know, UConn, Gino has and his staff, they've done a phenomenal job of coaching this season. And at, regardless of what he says, they've done an absolute phenomenal job of coaching. To how do you replace a Maya Moore? You don't, especially when you don't have another Maya Moore. But with that being said, Notre Dame has just been dominant in this tournament. It was a real wake-up call, I think, when they lost to UConn in the Big Ten tournament. And they have just been on a tear. I mean, look what they've done in this regional. I mean, they've won by an average of 37 points in these last two games. And SBU, you know, I know I'm a St. Bonaventure fan and all that, but they're a good team. I mean, this is the same St. Bonaventure team that beat St. John's earlier in the year, and they beat West Virginia. And they were 31, you know, they had 31 wins going into that Notre Dame game, and they just absolutely dismantled them, as well as Maryland, a number two seed. So I'm going to go with Notre Dame over UConn in this one.
You know, and I was going to let you slide on that last week, saying that you wouldn't be surprised if St. Bonaventure won. So you were the one that brought it up.
I just thought I would beat you to the punch.
Well, Steph, let's throw it over to the other coach. What's your thoughts on this?
I like Notre Dame, too. I think that they're deeper. I think they have more weapons. You know, I think that they absolutely had a wake-up call in the Big East tournament. They were not playing their best basketball, and I think that it helped them to get on a run in the regional. And I like what UConn has done. I think that it's certainly going to be a terrific basketball game, but I think down the stretch Notre Dame just has too much.
Christy?
Oh, we've got to agree with the ladies. I've got to go with Notre Dame. Just the way that they played yesterday, I think that they are playing with such a tremendous amount of confidence and balance within their system. And I think right now they're playing better than UConn, and their depth, I think, will be an issue down the stretch as well. But I've got to go with Notre Dame, and I guess I'll stick with Baylor. That's a tougher one for me, but I'm going to go with Baylor Notre Dame in the championship.
Well, I went actually on Connecticut radio this morning and picked against UConn, so I've already taken my life in my hands here. So I'm going to still say Notre Dame. I picked Notre Dame to be the team that could beat Baylor all season as the one team that could. So I will continue to go that route, and we will head over to the other regions. You know, one thing that was mentioned quickly, though, that I want to throw out there is, you know, a comment was made by one of you about the job that Gino did, changing the team over from being Maya Moore-centric to not having a dominant player this year. I believe it was Doug that said that. You know, and I found it really interesting in thinking about it that Tara Vanderveer, on the other hand, went from a team that had Poland and Peterson and the Agumakes and was so many options to turning her team into a NECA-centric team this year. They really sort of inverted their teams, and here they both sit once again. So, you know, I've said all along I'm going to go with Baylor to take care of this business one more time. Steph, who's your pick in the on that side with Baylor and Stanford?
I'm going to go with Baylor. You know, I think that they have been dominant all year long, and barring any freakish injury or anything like that, I think that with what Brittany Griner brings, with what Odyssey Sims brings, and their role players understand their roles and they play to those roles day in and day out, I just think that they're too tough.
Jimmy, they understand their roles?
And they understand their roles, and they shut their holes. They're very good at it.
So who's your pick?
I'm going to go with Baylor. I mean, don't let that whole nerd city thing with Stanford fool you. I mean, these kids are fearless and they're tough and they're very confident, but I just don't think that they have the firepower to compete with Baylor.
And, Doug, you are also Baylor bound?
I am part of the Lady Bear Express, I guess. They just have too many weapons, and I think that it'll be a good game for a half. I think that the Agumakeyes can keep them close, and they may even get Griner foul trouble if she has to guard Nekka and she pulls her outside. But I think there's just too many weapons on Baylor, and their defense is too tough at the guard slots, as we said with Odyssey before, that Stanford will unfortunately be 0-5 in the Final Four in the last 5 years.
And Mel?
Yeah, let's make it a complete swipe out. Baylor.
Well, now then on the other side, we'll throw right back. Let's take it to the finals. You have got Baylor playing somebody since you won't commit on the other game. So is Baylor going to beat both Notre Dame and UConn combined?
Well, it's going to be a Big East tag team match. That's how they're going to set it up. Each team's going to play a half. And, against Baylor. And they're the people that are happiest because they can't lose. Either way, they got a horse in this situation in the title game. I look at Baylor to win the whole thing. I think once they get past when they get there, I think it'll be an exciting game, no matter who plays against them, but give them an edge. I mean, Griner and Sims are just give you a little bit of extra.
Christy?
Well,
Christy?
I think that it's definitely going to be Baylor Notre Dame, but I just think that Baylor has a lot more speed on the perimeter in terms of their defense, and I think that's going to create some problems in terms of the flow of offense for Notre Dame. So I'm going to go with Baylor to go 40-0 this season and win the whole thing.
Jimmy?
Sick'em Bears.
That was easy. Stephanie?
Yeah, I got Baylor. I really just think that this year they're too good and they're too tough to handle.
And Doug, I'm going to give you the chance. You're the one person that picked UConn.
I as much as I'd love to say the Bears are going to win it, I got to go with my heart and my first choice. Never go against your first impression, right? And I still think if they make it past Notre Dame, it's tough to beat Geno twice in a year. And Tennessee knows all about that, and a lot of other schools know all about that, about beating the regular season and then doing it in the NCAA tournament. And if there's any coach in the country besides Kim Mulkey who may know how to contain, because you can't stop her, Brittany Griner, it's Geno after the 2 weeks he spent with her on the USA training camp and the month he'll spend with her looking forward to probably the summer and the Olympics. Next year he'll definitely know how to contain her, but I got to stick with my UConn choice, and I think it's going to be a UConn beating Baylor in the championship game.
There you go. We've got one person that can come live in my neighborhood successfully. Everybody else is no longer going to be welcome in the state of Connecticut. All right. Well, I'd like to thank all of you for participating and being a part of this. And the way we usually like to wrap things up is I like to go around, give you one last opportunity to say where people could find you, if you'd like to give your Twitter or where you're going to be covering next or any type of event that you'd like to mention, plus anything you'd like to say about the game or anything else out there, feel free to give the listeners one last shot at whatever you'd like them to hear about you. So we might as well we'll start with Doug, since you wrap us up with Connecticut.
Well, you can find me in Denver starting Thursday night through Wednesday morning at the Final Four, which should, I think, be one of the best Final Fours in recent memory, just because I think as much as we talked about how it should be Baylor and Notre Dame or UConn or no one's really giving Stanford too much of a chance, the four best teams in the country made it to the championship round this year. And I think that's something special. They four sort of set themselves apart as the best teams in the country from November, and now we play the last weekend of the season and the four are still standing. So that to me is pretty impressive, and I think it will be a really, really interesting Final Four this weekend. You can find me at Doug Feinberg on Twitter, or as we always like to say at the AP, in all papers across the country somewhere.
Christy.
Well, I will not be in Denver, but I will be watching very closely to the screen. But you can find me on Twitter at ChristyWScott51, and I do have fun tweeting during the games. So it is a lot of fun to have the basketball minds and the basketball world to talk to during the games. But I am directing a spring break camp next week for the Washington Wizards and Mystics. So I'll have my three with me during the week at the spring break camps.
Sounds good. Shimmy.
You can find me on Twitter as well. I'm Shimmy33. That's what I do these days in lieu of having a real job. And I feel like I do it quite well, actually, maybe better than I did my real job. That's why I don't have a real job anymore. But otherwise, you can find me in Denver as well. I think that this Final Four will be one to remember. It's like Doug said, you've got the four best teams year-round, not just through this tournament, but year-round, all season long, and they're going to be going head-to-head next weekend, and it's going to be a lot of fun to watch.
Mel?
Twitter-wise, Juan Hoops Guru, and then on the blog, you can find me at Juan Hoops Blogspot, or you can do MelGreenberg.com, and then just click on the little archive option there in case I'm doing more than one. At some point, I'm supposed to arrive in Denver on Friday, and when we're not, Doug and I aren't working. Can't tell you exactly where to find me yet, but it'll be more in a few places.
And Stephanie, thanks again for joining us and being a first-timer on the roundtable. Where can we find you these days, and what have you got coming up?
Well, I am on Twitter now, as opposed to the last time we were on a roundtable discussion. So you can find me at SWhiteJ2 on Twitter. And I am not going to Denver this year. I will be watching from my couch and hoping that it's an entertaining Final Four. And then this summer with the Indiana Fever. So anybody who wants to come on up to the Mohegan Sun from your neck of the woods would welcome them. Come up and root for or against the Fever. It's okay as long as you're in the house.
Getting that draft preparation work done?
Yes, draft preparation. Offense preparation, defense preparation, it's putting the coaching hat back on.
I've always wondered, how difficult is it to get used to, get ready to coach again after broadcasting, and how difficult is it to watch a game and not try to say, they would look really good in an Indiana Fever uniform?
Well, it's what do you tell shooters? You got to have short memories because you don't want to keep shooting it. Well, I have a short memory, so it's when I'm in the broadcast mode, I'm in the broadcast mode. When I'm watching on TV, it's much easier to be the coach than when I'm watching from the sideline. Just as it is much easier to be the official when you're watching it on TV as well. So I try to put on all those hats.
Well, again, thank you all for participating. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Dish N, the letter N, Swish, and, of course, on HoopFeed.com. I hope that you had an opportunity and you enjoyed reading the Dishing on the Brackets series that we did, and then Dishing on the Elite Eight games. It was a lot of fun writing those, and I appreciate everybody that read them and gave us all of those great hits. On the website, we thank you. So we will be back next week. We will have something to do with wrapping up the tournament, and then we got to start getting ready for the draft ourselves. And that's another whole story to be coming up soon. So again, thank you to everybody. I hope you all have great times in Denver or on your sofas. Thanks again for your time, and it's been a lot of fun.
Thank you, Dave.
Thank you.